session number 12371.
With a much larger sight, which was going to be mounted not very many inches from my face. We took off on our very first sortie in our new aeroplane with its new camouflage and its new gun sight. We were put on a patrol line about 80 miles off Hull. It was a bright moonlight night, and there didn't seem to be anything happening, when all of a sudden sector operations called up to say that there was a bandit coming in from the east. Well, now, it was virtually impossible to get the fighter close enough to a target so that its own radar could pick that target up from a plot off the operations room table. And I knew, because of the distance out we were, that that's exactly what they were doing. It was different when your target got closer in and you then came under a GCI control, that's a radar control, because they could see both the target and the fighter quite clearly. But the plots off the operation room tables were often so far out that there was no way that they could really get one close enough for one's own radar to pick the target up. And so when they told me this target was coming in, I didn't take too much interest. I turned roughly onto a course towards the direction in which they said it was coming and didn't think much more, when all of a sudden my operator in the back of the aircraft shouted contact, and we picked him up. Well, we went through the process of getting behind him and beginning to synchronize our speeds, because the one thing you couldn't afford to do on these sorts of interception was to come racing up behind the target, because by the time you'd seen it, you'd probably overshoot it. So the most important thing was to synchronize your speeds first and then slowly accelerate up to the target. As I say, it was a bright moonlight night, and unfortunately we were down moon. We were at about 18,000 feet when I saw the target, which was a Dornier 17. He was above me about 100 feet, slightly to the port side. I told my operator that I could see him, and I was just getting ready to pull across behind him and to pull up and open fire with my four cannon and six machine guns, when he obviously saw us first and opened fire from his dorsal gun position. He was firing 13mm armor-piercing incendiary. And I think he may have only fired about 50 rounds, but he hit us first time. My port engine caught fire, and one of the shells came through the cockpit window. Must have missed my head by inches, because it hit the electrical power line, the main electrical power line, and the main hydraulic line, both of which ran down the side of the aircraft just above my head on the left-hand side. So not only have we now got our port engine on fire, but we lost all our electrics, and the hydraulic oil squirted all over me and all over the instruments and all over the inside of the cockpit so that I couldn't see out. My operator called up, "Look out, he's coming down on your tail." This was a fully laden German bomber. So I just stuffed my nose down and went vertically downwards. Obviously the speed we gathered in the dive helped to put out the fire, I having already pushed the fire extinguisher button. And when I pulled out at about 2,500 feet, I could scarcely see out at all. My operator came forward and helped clear the mess from the front windscreen and off some of the instruments. And I then called for an emergency homing from Church Fenton. I was now on one engine, obviously. And of course the Beaufighter didn't have any feathering, so one had this problem of having quite a lot of drag from the dead engine. We had to use our radio sparingly because now we were on battery because all our electrics had been taken out. I received a homing from Church Fenton and set off. Crossed the coast, and the next thing was my operator shouted out, "Look out for the balloons," and we were right in the middle of the Hull balloon barrage, which was flying at about 6,000 feet. Well, of course, it was ridiculous, because he was saying, "Look, there's one up there on the left," and I'd veer away to the right, but I mean, it was quite obvious that trying to avoid these balloon cables like that was quite ridiculous. But just by the grace of God, we somehow flew right through the Hull balloon barrage at 2,500 feet and came out the other side. When I got back to Church Fenton, I was unable to operate either my flaps or my undercarriage, and so I was forced to make a crash landing with wheels up on the grass by the side of the runway. Again, the obvious thing happened. I hit my face on this GM2 gun sight that I have mounted, but it didn't do any great damage. But interestingly, the following morning, when I went out to have a look at the aircraft to see exactly where the damage was and what damage was done, in the well of the aircraft, behind the pilot's seat, which was where the pilot normally made his entrance and exit, except when the aircraft was lying on its belly, was the 13mm shell that had come through the window and had gone through the hydraulic and electrical cables, and I still have that shell today. The following night, obviously in another aircraft, we were up again and there was a lot of activity. Now, quite a lot of the German aircraft coming into Hull and Liverpool came from the area of Schiphol, which is now Amsterdam Airport. And they always returned on a bearing of about 135 degrees. After my previous night's experience, I made up my mind that if I picked up a target tonight, I was going to start firing at it out of range and go in absolutely flat out to make sure I got my shot in first. We were just near the coast, near Northcote's Fitties, when all of a sudden my operator said he got a contact. The contact was going out on 135. This was in August, in the middle of the summer, and it wasn't long before dawn. I picked the target up and thought at the range I picked it up that it looked like a Dornier 17. I turned on all my guns, opened the throttles, put my sight on, opened fire. And directly I opened fire, my operator shouted out, "Look out, he's fired the colours of the day." So I stopped firing, and we came up alongside the target, and it turned out to be a Whitley. Fortunately, we hadn't hit it. But even to this day, I've never been able to discover what a Whitley was doing flying towards Holland just before dawn in the middle of the summer. And so it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. It was a German aircraft, captured aircraft that they were using for their own purposes.
Did it have any insignia on?
You couldn't see in the dark. But as I say, my actions were influenced entirely, and wrongly I might say, by what had happened the previous night. Another incident that happened while I was at Church Fenton, which perhaps is interesting in its way. In all the night fighter squadrons, there were about five or six what they called star crews, and these were the most experienced crews in the squadron who had to be ready to take off and operate in any weather, because it was quite obvious that in bad weather it was no good launching inexperienced crews because you were going to lose them through weather. But there were these five or six crews that had to be prepared to operate in any weather, even if they had to bail out at the end of the sortie. Well, this particular night was one of these nights. There was a lot of fog about, and some Huns were coming in from the east, and I got airborne. I knew I wasn't going to be able to land back at Church Fenton because the fog from the Humber used to roll in very quickly in these conditions. Well, we had one or two attempted interceptions which came to nothing, and eventually everything quietened down. And I was vectored by sector operations to an airfield called Colby Grange, which is not very far from Boston in Lincolnshire, and was an airfield that was presently occupied by a Canadian night fighter squadron equipped with the Beaufighter 2, which was the Beaufighter that had Merlin engines. Well, in the Beaufighter, we had, as part of our radar, a homing and a blind landing facility. The homing facility was simply a question of homing onto a radar beacon that was on top of the air traffic control of the airfield you were homing to, and was called Mother. The blind landing facility was another beacon that was situated just short of the main runway and was called Father. The use of this particular thing was a bit of a hit and miss affair, because you had to make all your height adjustments entirely by guesswork. In other words, you will get yourself lined up on Father, and your operator in the back will keep telling you how far you were from Father, and so you lowered yourself down so that with any luck you passed over Father at the height that enabled you to land. But clearly this was a facility that could only be used when there was a reasonable degree of visibility below the cloud base or whatever one was using Father to land by. On this occasion we arrived at Colby Grange above the fog, and I started to let down. We picked up Father, and we were coming in thick fog, and I got down to about 100 feet, and I couldn't see anything at all, and I came to the conclusion it was absolute lunacy to go on, and so I opened up and climbed up again and called up Sector Ops and said, I can't get into Colby Grange. Well, by this time, of course, all the airfields were closing in, and it looked very much as if we might be forced to bail out. But I was given another vector. They didn't tell me where I was going. And eventually, I arrived over this airfield, which was not yet fogged in, although it was beginning to start. I flew around the circuit. I came in, approached, and directly I touched the ground, I realised, A, that I was on grass, and B, that I was going downhill. Wet grass and downhill is not too good in a 10-ton bowfighter. We started to slow down, but it was patently obvious. I saw the boundary lights coming towards me that we weren't going to stop. And so I ground looped the aircraft, that is, I swung it sideways, and we slid along sideways for quite some way. Fortunately, the undercarriage didn't collapse, because I think the grass was probably so wet. And we pulled up, really only yards from the boundary fence. By this time, the fog had really got fairly thick. We didn't know where we were, and so my operator got out, and he walked over to the with a torch to the boundary fence, and then came back and said the best thing to do would be to follow the boundary fence round until we came to something recognisable. Well, we were just about to do this when one of these follow me vehicles arrived from air traffic control, and he got himself in front of me, and I was just about to follow him when all of a sudden he shot off to one side, and I saw a red and a green light coming towards me, which was another aircraft landing. Well, one thing that the Hercules engine doesn't like is having the throttle open very quickly, because it tends to cough and splutter. But when you see this situation descending upon you, there is an inclination to do this, which is what I did, and there was a great spluttering and banging. Then fortunately the engine picked up, and we just managed to get out of the way before a Hudson went sliding past me, also going sideways. Unfortunately, he stopped as well, just before he went through the boundary fence. It's perhaps interesting to note that when we got back to the air traffic control eventually, we were at an airfield called Curtin in Lindsay, which I'd have thought twice about landing in a bowfighter during daylight, let alone at night, and certainly not downhill. But I also discovered that the Hudson that had landed behind me belonged to number 53 squadron, which was the first squadron I'd been in at the beginning of the war. That, in effect, was the end of my night fighter tour, because I was now tour expired, and moreover I was obviously getting tired, because I started to fall asleep in the air at night, or doze off on patrol, and this clearly was not a very good thing. And so I was posted to Accrington, where they trained these radar operators who operated the radar on the back of the night fighters. We did this on the Anson aircraft, and I was going to command a flight up there, stooging around in an Anson so that these chaps could learn how to operate their radar. Well, I didn't fancy this one little bit. And so I went down to number 12 group, where my old station commander, Basil Embry, was now the senior air staff officer as an air commodore. Now, one thing Basil did not like were flying people who didn't fly, and the one thing he did like were flying people who wanted to fly. And I went and saw Basil, and I said, "Look, sir, I've been posted to this ghastly job up in Accrington." I said, "Do you think there's any chance of getting me onto day fighters?" Well, of course, at that time, to get onto day fighters in the rank of squadron leader was virtually impossible. They couldn't have people who'd not operated in that particular role suddenly becoming squadron commanders, because day fighting is very much a mutual support operation, and you can't have lame ducks, and certainly not up at the front end. So one's chances of getting into a day fighter squadron, as I say, as a squadron leader, were not good. I added at the time, I said, perhaps I could go to one of these whirlwind squadrons. Now, the Westland Whirlwind was a little twin-engined single-seater fighter, of which there were only two squadrons, but it, with all my twin-engined experience, it seemed to me there might be a vague chance that I might be able to get into one of these squadrons. Basil said, "Well, leave it with me." And a week later, I was posted to number 137 Whirlwind Squadron at Manston in Kent as a supernumerary squadron leader.
This was still in 42.
This was in the end of August 1942. As a supernumerary squadron leader, I would just fly as an ordinary pilot, and to start with, I'd be the most junior pilot in the squadron, as I hadn't done any of that sort of thing before. But as I gained experience, it was hoped that I would then be able to take over the squadron, because the present squadron commander had already been with the squadron for over 2 years, and clearly he was getting to a stage when he would soon become tour expired. So I arrived at Manston, and I joined number 137 Squadron, and I was posted to A Flight, where my flight commander, having checked me out on the aircraft, then took me up and invited me to follow him through a series of fighter manoeuvres, most of which I didn't succeed in doing very successfully, which just showed what one was up against. One clearly couldn't go into this sort of operation unless you had some experience and certainly the right sort of ability. But after a few exercises of this sort, one began to get the hang of it. From then on, I operated as an ordinary pilot in the squadron on these aircraft, which were being used as fighter bombers. The Whirlwind was an unusual aeroplane. It had been designed before the war and was way ahead of its time. It had four cannon, which no other aircraft had at that time. And these were mounted in the nose, which put them right down the line of sight of the gun sight, which made harmonization much easier. As we all know, most fighter guns were in the wings, which made harmonization that much more difficult. This particular situation of the guns was of great value in the air-to-ground row, firing against ground targets, which was what we were doing most of the time. The aircraft was very fast at low level, very manoeuvrable. was one of the first aircraft to have the teardrop hood, which gave one very good visibility. It was a very easy aeroplane to fly, although it had a rather high approach and touchdown speed, which was considerably reduced by the fact it had big Fowler flaps that came down and almost touched the ground when they were fully extended. The aeroplane had suffered a series of setbacks during its development stage, which was not helped by the fact that the Air Ministry lost interest in it in 1940, and more emphasis was given to the production of new marks of Spitfire and Hurricane, and moreover, funnily enough, the Lysander, which by this time had become completely obsolescent and didn't really find its role until it was used to ferry agents to the continent. But the development of the Lysander at that time and the concentration on developing new marks for Spitfire and Hurricane set back the Whirlwind. And by the time the Whirlwind had overcome a number of teething troubles, which I won't go into here, the Spitfire with cannon and the Hurricane with cannon had been brought into service, and it was felt that there was no real requirement to develop a third fighter, particularly as the Typhoon, which was designed to succeed both the Hurricane and the Spitfire, was now on the designer's block. And so only 114 Whirlwinds were built, and from this they formed firstly number 263 squadron, and then from number 263 squadron they formed the second squadron, number 137 squadron. So there were only ever two Whirlwind squadrons. And eventually, although they started off in varying roles, they were even at one time thought of as night fighters, and number 25 squadron were given two or three of them for a short time. But clearly they weren't suitable for that role. They were thought of as a long-range fighter, but they hadn't got the range for that role. In fact, they were very short-range. And they eventually found their niche as fighter bombers. And it was in this role, with number 263 squadron operating from Warmbull and operating in an area south of the Seine, which included the Channel Islands, and number 137 squadron operating from Manston in an area north of the Seine up to the Scheldt, that they really found their niche. Their operations were divided against two types of target. Firstly, they were used against coastal shipping and the slightly larger shipping that was going through the straits, on which the Germans were depending quite a lot at that time. And secondly, they were used low level against various targets on the continent within their range. The trouble with the Whirlwind was that it had no long-range tanks, and neither was it designed to have long-range tanks fitted. It was designed as an interceptor to operate over this country, and therefore its range and its endurance were very limited. We carried either two 250-pound bombs or two 500-pound bombs, usually 250 pounds. We carried 500-pound bombs for certain types of target, but mainly the 250-pound bomb. As I say, the aeroplane was very fast at low level, and in fact, the 190 was the only aircraft, the FW-190 was the only aircraft that was faster than the Whirlwind at low level. When the Whirlwind was stripped, which of course it wasn't, we were...